Chapter 21. Fear springs from ignorance. It is when power is wedded to chronic fear that it becomes formidable. Eric Hoffer. We are afraid of what we do not understand. If life is a process of discovery, we are in a constant search for guidance. Our imperfect maps of how the world works have many blank areas, and like the cartographers of old, we fill these spaces with dragons. We begin to control our fears in our battles against ignorance. The first step in understanding fear is to recognize those similarities of emotion and purpose that we share with others. All human connections are temporary and subject to change. Although people nearly always see themselves as good judges of character, the success of Ponzi schemes, the response to emails promising great wealth for little effort, and our divorce rate all demonstrate that we are fallible in our attempts to judge the character and intentions of others. We repose our hopes in those we imagine we can trust, only to be surprised when they do not deliver what they promised. With equal frequency, we are disappointed in ourselves when we fail to meet our own expectations of accomplishment and fidelity. Fear and cynicism lie at the heart of our difficulty establishing trust. Because long-term relationships fail at such a painful and spectacular rate, our efforts to protect ourselves from disappointment are natural. However, attempts to avoid heartbreak undermine our ability to commit ourselves fully, which is our only hope of getting what we truly want. In a larger sense, we are betrayed by our tendency to place outside ourselves the responsibility for the disparity between what we have and what we wish for. We appear to have a fundamental desire to blame others for what happens to us. We are entertained by a culture of victimization. Our upbringings are mined to discover shortcomings in our parents that would explain our unhappiness. We form organizations aimed at exploring the consequences of parental alcoholism, abuse, and neglect. We gather with others who have had similar experiences and whose lives have been warped by their pasts. As vehicles for understanding what has happened to us, these efforts have merit. As a way of displacing responsibility for our present and future, they are less useful. I have written elsewhere about invoking a statute of limitations on our childhood traumas. Again, the attachment to a sense of victimization is a form of fear about what we need to do to overcome our pasts. Many fears can dominate our lives. Fear of intimacy, failure, responsibility, the rapid passage of time, and death. Why is there so little discussion of these natural human apprehensions and how to mobilize the courage to live optimistic, authentic lives in the face of them? Wouldn't you imagine that such subjects ought to occupy a significant portion of every high school curriculum? What does it say about us that we seldom talk about such things with our children? Instead, their heads and ours are filled with the most superficial images of worldly success. It is ironic that we lavish so much worry on our children's development and safety while ignoring the real risks to their future happiness. We transmit to them, in ways large and small, our sense that the world is dangerous and unpredictable. We worry that they will smoke, drink, or engage in dangerous sex. We have an exaggerated sense of our power to shape their lives. We devour conflicting advice from experts about how to raise exceptional or at least above-average children. We put bumper stickers on our cars, attesting to their successes. And yet we give little attention to what we are teaching them by our example. How often do our children see us reading a book, acting in a generous way toward a stranger, thoughtfully discussing an idea, expressing affection to a spouse, demonstrating gratitude for a kindness? Some adults, not you, of course, go days without doing any of these things. Do we imagine that values are taught through lectures and criticism? Why do young people pay more attention to each other and to their cultural heroes than they do their parents? The families I see in therapy are usually embroiled in conflict with children who openly express disrespect for their parents. But what of the larger number of families in which parents are simply seen by their kids as having little that is relevant to teach them? Indifference is in some ways worse than hostility. The less information we have about something or someone, the more threatened we are likely to feel about it or them. With the increasing polarization of cable news, most of us now learn about the world by listening to people with whom we agree politically and philosophically. Newspapers, more reliable sources of objective information, are dying. And the Internet is a Wild West melange of fact, fable, and opinion that is now the primary source of news, especially for the young. The commentators with the greatest popularity are unabashed partisans who thrive in an atmosphere of apocalyptic controversy. Reason is replaced by emotion, and those with opposing views are routinely demonized as unpatriotic, subversive, or uninformed. This atmosphere of confrontation and fear-mongering gives rise to political figures who stake out extreme positions and pander to the 25% of the population receptive to conspiracy theories that threaten their conception of how the country should be governed. When sufficiently aroused, this portion of the electorate is large enough and well enough funded that they can exercise a disproportionate influence on the electoral process. They tend to be religious, which adds to their fervor, and preoccupied with any perceived threat to their narrow definitions of virtue. They are nostalgic for a misremembered past, when there was less crime and more respect for authority, when the country was led by white men, when we had never lost a war, except, of course, for the Civil War, and when women and minorities knew their places, everyone believed in God, extended families lived together, few people got divorced, children were more tractable, music more comprehensible and less loud, and hardly anyone knew someone who was gay. The fact that white people will be in the minority in the United States by 2050 is an extremely uncomfortable reality for a significant portion of the population. This group tends to have rigid ideas about child rearing and a fondness for punishment as an instrument of social control. This philosophy, based on fear, can extend from a belief in corporal punishment for children to an enthusiasm for the death penalty unique in the Western world. The need to own handguns and assault rifles is a reflection of both fear that others may take what is yours by force and a belief that an armed populace is the ultimate defense against governmental tyranny. Women must be punished for irresponsible sex by being forced to bear unwanted children. This is characterized as a right to life and is based entirely on a religious definition of when life begins that must be enforced by the government. What is absent in this quarter of our fellow citizens is the idea that others with different belief deserve toleration. This coercive aspect of fundamentalist conviction causes the rest of us to feel that we are getting a whiff of theocracy at work. Those who would blur the lines between church and state, who are eager to inject prayer into the public space, who see the Ten Commandments as the basis of our legal system, and who perceive the world as a twilight struggle between the forces of good and evil, are not likely to welcome the multicultural society that we are moving toward. In this sense, they are similar to the fanatics in the Muslim world, whose ideology is likewise based on ancient and infallible texts, and is at war with modernity. We struggle to make peace with the past, at least that part of it we can agree on. But our real task is to come to terms with a future that we may never see, but which we are in the process of shaping. That unimaginable world, inhabited by our grandchildren and their grandchildren, must, if we are able to reach it at all, be a place where people are free to pursue their lives as they see fit, as long as they do not infringe on the rights of others to live according to their lights. The fears we must cope with as human beings should not be made worse by worries that those with different beliefs will force us to be like them. Chapter 22. It is pointless to fear the past. A last letter to my birth mother. Dear Ruth, in our 30 years of knowing each other, two moments stand out. When we first met, and when I saw you for the last time. At the age of 35, I had just found out I was adopted. My parents, in their fear and insecurity, had omitted that detail during my upbringing. I think they felt guilty about buying me from the infamous Tennessee Children's Home so long ago. Some people ponder their worth. I know mine exactly. $500. They had a legal decree saying that I was theirs, but still they must have wondered about the woman whose child they were raising. Well, you know the story. I found out about my adoption, searched you out, and called. Here I was, an upstate New Yorker, talking to a stranger with a molasses Mississippi voice, imagining that I would have to convince her that I was who I said I was. I'll never forget your response. What took you so long? And so you opened your door and your heart to me, and I was looking at the first person, apart from my children, to whom I had a blood relationship. I was so glad that I hadn't let that lawyer in Memphis talk me into letting him find you. Whatever was going to happen was between us. You were welcoming, but afraid. Glad to see that things had turned out well for me. But sure that I shared your own conviction that you didn't live up to the moment of my birth. I tried to reassure you that I understood what it must have been like to be a single school teacher in a small southern town, pregnant by a man you could not have. It must have been hard to spend those months in Memphis before I was born, far from home and under the control of people who wanted to sell your baby. And signing that piece of paper that let me go cost you so many years of regret, especially since you had already named me. But it was 1938, and you were alone. What else could you do? You carried your secret, and my adoptive parents carried theirs. So I found you, and told you of my life, including my four children, the youngest of whom, Michael, is adopted. You had remained single and told me that amazing story of changing the grade you taught each year in elementary school to correspond to the one you knew I must be in somewhere. Now I had returned, and you didn't know where I fit in your life, or whether there was a place for you in mine. You had given birth to me, but could never be my mother. So you became a grandmother to my children, visiting, remembering birthdays. I have a picture of you and Michael, and I marvel at the connections that life makes and what constitutes a family. I don't think we ever got past the sadness of that long-ago relinquishment. I thought I understood, but truthfully, looking at my own children, I could not imagine it. I don't think you ever forgave yourself, and our every contact was burdened by the 35 missing years. Yet we were friends. I took comfort in my biological connections. You were reassured that the son cast adrift had been loved and had found his way. After the Alzheimer's began to steal you from me 5 years ago, it gave me a chance to say goodbye before your earthly connections faded entirely into forgetfulness. You did not speak my name on that last visit, perhaps because it is different than the name you gave me. You were in a place for the old in the town where you grew up, and I was conceived, close to your roots, far from mine. Your thoughts were veiled by a curtain of half-memories. I wanted to ask if you ever thought about what we might have been to each other, but I could not fill the past with what it did not contain. Parted at birth, reunited as strangers, the years gone by with the blowing leaf hung between us still. I embraced you one last time and said what I should have said before. Thank you for my life. Love, Gordon. Born David. Angus. I have only one picture of my father. It was taken at his work when he was in his mid-40s. He stares solemnly and without surprise at the camera, looking much the determined businessman. In the background are file cabinets, and in one corner of the picture is the hand of another person holding a piece of paper that awaits my father's attention. He is wearing a white shirt and a paisley tie with an odd design spilling across it that I cannot identify. I examine the photo with a magnifying glass, like a detective or an archaeologist trying to decipher its meaning. I strain to see my face in his. It is all I have of him, this snapshot. I have never heard his voice, never felt his touch. He stares at me across the years. This man who gave me life and nothing more. I have questions for him, but he died before I could find him, before I was even aware he existed. My birth was the outcome of his hurried coupling with my mother on an October night in Vicksburg, Mississippi. It was a pathetically unsuccessful attempt by a lonely school teacher to bind this man to her. For him, I suppose she was a target of opportunity, and the resulting pregnancy, though no doubt embarrassing, was ultimately not his problem. He offered to finance an abortion, but something, perhaps having to go to New Orleans to get it, perhaps her religious family, perhaps even the hope that my father might change his mind and make an honest woman of her, gave her pause, and I was born. She kept me only a week. He never saw me at all. I was left in the company of strangers who, fortunately, chose to love me as their own, only to have their hearts broken 13 months later when the agency sold me to a couple who could pay. Many years afterward, I came looking for these shadowy people from my past. I found them all, except for my father, who had died, leaving behind this picture. His name was Angus Hearn, so the Scottish ancestry provided by my adoptive parents was right after all. I wonder now what kind of life I would have lived in the Delta country of Mississippi. The people I found there, my birth mother and her family, speak with a euphonious lilt foreign to my Yankee ear. Well, I surely am glad to see you. They are tolerant and kind, free of the small-town bigotry that was my own prejudiced expectation. My mother had no other children, never married. My father, though, according to his obituary, did marry and had one daughter. This was exciting news. After a lifetime as an only child, I had a half-sister. I found out where she was and wrote her a letter introducing myself. She called immediately, excited also. It turned out, though, that Angus and his wife had adopted her, and she was contemplating a search for her origins. Angus kept his secret even as Ruth kept hers, and my adoptive parents kept theirs. All motives were at once benign and fearful. To protect themselves and those they loved or would love from the truth of my existence. But beneath these secrets lay other wishes less noble, more selfish. My birth parents, that they had ignited a life and then abandoned it. My adoptive parents, that they could not conceive and so chose to raise the child of strangers. The lie was preserved in a kind of bargain struck between two sets of parents who would never meet. And it was left to me to discover that I, simply by being born, was the source of the shame that all secrecy implies. Chapter 23. There are wounds that doctors cannot reach, that gratitude cannot heal. Memory and devotion. With them, our hearts, though broken, will be full, and we will stay in the fight to the very last. Mark Helprin, a soldier of the Great War. Every year, when Memorial Day rolls around, I listen to the predictable statements of appreciation for the sacrifices of those who have died in our nation's wars. They relinquished their futures at our behest, and we are obligated to be grateful. When I was in Vietnam, 1968 to 69, the first thing I noticed was that the actual fighting was done by the less than 20% of soldiers, grunts, unfortunate enough to be assigned to the infantry or marine rifle companies. There was, as I recall, little talk of freedom or democracy among them. The other 80% of our troops, REMFs, were busy driving trucks, maintaining PX facilities, sitting around some headquarters, or working as lifeguards in the Long Binh swimming pool. Now they are all Vietnam veterans whom we are expected to honor. Another important discovery I made at war was that in a combat unit, what separates the dead from the survivors is not courage, but luck. The person who took the AK-47 round, stepped on the mine, bled to death before the medevac arrived, was random. So when I look for a familiar name on the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, I do so with an appreciation for the power of chance. When I stand back far enough that I can see the entire black granite wall with its 58,000 names, the following questions cross my mind. What the hell was that for? What is here for the families of these men, the parents with fading memories, the grown children with no memories at all? Is my freedom more secure because of these sacrifices to the God of unintended consequences? How big a wall would it take to list the 2 million Vietnamese, North and South, killed while we were there? What we owe our veterans, living and dead, is the truth. For their losses and our own cannot be redeemed with sanctification or hyperbolic remembrance. It is easy to wax sentimental each Memorial Day about our unforgotten heroes. But if all we do is put on American Legion hats and lay wreaths and enshrine the memories of our unlucky countrymen, we miss the opportunity to learn something from their fates. Something about what happens when patriotism is equated to support for the latest military adventure, and who pays the price. Since Vietnam, we have had Grenada, Panama, Dominican Republic, Beirut, Somalia, the 100-hour walkover in the Persian Gulf, the 21st-century adventures in Iraq and Afghanistan. Do the families of the men and now women lost in these places find themselves grateful and at peace with their sacrifices? I wish it were so, but I doubt it. Sentimentality is a popular form of untruth. One example is the creation of heroes. Who better to nominate than those who have died defending the nation and its values? To bring out the flags and remember them once or twice a year seems little enough to ask of ourselves in the face of what they have lost. The problem with this ceremonial remembrance for me is that it seems self-indulgent. We cannot repay the families of our lost soldiers. Families who must find consolation apart from the ceremonial remembrance of those who do not share their sacrifices. Rather than simply honoring the men and women we have lost, we are celebrating the notion that we live in a world in which we resolve conflicting ideas about how to live only by force. We tell ourselves that each military undertaking is required because some value, liberty, democracy, is threatened and must be defended. The instruments of such defense are the sons and daughters who are willing to hazard their lives if their country asks them to. Next Memorial Day, before you join in romantic reverence for the dead with its implied willingness to add to that number, I ask you to think again about the cost, not of liberty, but of misjudgment. I would not wish on you my own memories of young men who at the end could only call for their mothers as their lives leaked away far from home. Chapter 24. Courage is required to bear the unbearable. The life of every man is a diary in which he means to write one story and writes another, and his humblest hour is when he compares the volume it is with what he vowed to make it. J.M. Barrie. On the wall of our bedroom hang two pictures. One is of my daughter Emily when she was 8. She is beautiful, smiling confidently into the camera, her arms crossed. The other is of her 3-year-old brother Lucas. He is on the cusp between a baby and a small boy. His blonde hair is sparse, his mouth slightly open. He is wearing a white sweater, and in his eyes is a look I construe now as trust. A much-loved child who cannot imagine any harm befalling him. The pictures were taken 23 years ago. The colors have faded slightly. Emily graduated from law school and works for a U.S. senator. Lucas died in the spring of 1992 at the age of 6. 6 months before his death, he was diagnosed with acute myelocytic leukemia, the result of the random mutation of a cell deep within his otherwise perfect body. The odds of any child developing leukemia are roughly 1 in 50,000. The struggle to save his life included chemotherapy and eventually a bone marrow transplant. I was the donor. My marrow was not a perfect match, but it was close enough that the doctors persuaded us to try the procedure since his chances for survival without it were poor. He developed something called graft versus host disease, which means that my transplanted cells attacked his body and compromised his vital organs. He became sick and sicker until he bled uncontrollably. His stomach was perforated and he died. He was intubated and unconscious near the end. But the moment when his mother told him that he could stop struggling for life, that we would all be okay and would see him in another time and place, is seared into my memory. I remember the pictures of Hiroshima after the atomic bombing. There were shadows on the walls of people who had been vaporized by the explosion. I am afraid that if we went back to the Johns Hopkins Pediatric Intensive Care Unit, we would see our shadows on those walls. And yet here we are, these many years later, still loving him, wondering what his life would have been like. Our grief has softened. Gregory Peck, who lost a son, said in an interview once, "I don't think of him every day. I think of him every hour of every day." Lucas remains a living presence in our lives. When we travel, his picture comes with us. With the help of many friends, we set up a housing alternative for families with children being treated for cancer at Johns Hopkins. Lucas's name is on the door, and people who have found refuge there write us letters that we treasure. Like most bereaved parents, we have developed an abiding hatred for the word closure. Many well-meaning attempts at consolation, "he's in a better place," demonstrate how little people understand. I have not been back to church since his funeral. Although I know many who have drawn comfort from their faith after such a loss, for me it would be a betrayal of my love for my son to imagine his dying as part of some divine plan. His death has made my own easier to contemplate. I hope for a reunion with him, even as I reject the faith that promises it. For a long time I searched for him in crowds of children. Small boys with blonde heads seen from a distance made me stop for a second look. I don't do that anymore. We could not move from our house, at least partly because we still imagined him finding us there. I have fallen back on a belief in a kind of law of conservation of energy. People die, but love is never lost. During his short life, he evoked in me feelings of which I did not know I was capable. That, it turned out, was his permanent gift to me. The process of mourning did teach me some things, however. It stripped me of the illusion of control, and I know now, in a way that most people don't, the futility of imagining that we have it. In a world where nobody gets out of here alive, we can take this truth as a reason for despair or as a way to mobilize the courage to get up each morning. Here is where we have a choice. As my son's soul left his body, I imagined it like the balloons he so loved, floating gently downwind. I thought I could not bear living without him, or the thought of his being without us. And yet I have. As I now approach the western horizon of my life, it is with the fragile but persistent hope that my endless love for my little boy will dignify my existence and entitle me once more to hold him in my arms. Chapter 25. Ignorance can be remedied. Stupidity has no cure. He who fights with monsters might take care lest he thereby become a monster. And if you gaze for long into an abyss, the abyss gazes also into you. Nietzsche. In February 2003, as we prepared to go to war in Iraq, the space shuttle Columbia disintegrated, killing all aboard. I wrote the following op-ed piece for our local newspaper. In our national grief over the loss of the space shuttle, we are in danger of overlooking some lessons from the tragedy. It is inevitable that we glorify the dead astronauts beyond what they were. Smart, courageous people, conscious of the risks but willing to take them to enjoy the thrill of being space travelers. That they were patriotic and dedicated to their jobs is beside the point. The applicants for such work are legion. And in pre-flight interviews, the astronauts repeatedly characterized their experience as fun and exciting. An activity that requires people to travel 18,000 miles an hour with re-entry temperatures in excess of 3,000 degrees is obviously dangerous and unforgiving of any malfunction. There is enough history of mechanical mishaps in the 42 years of the space program to have killed 10 astronauts before Columbia disintegrated. The investigation into the cause of the disaster has just begun. No doubt the experts will find something to explain it. They always do. But does anyone think we have seen the last fatality in our exploration of space? As we push on to Mars, the risks increase, and thankfully there will always be people eager to take them. The eventual pinpointing of the cause of the disaster will, as with the Challenger explosion in 1986, reassure us that some correction will be made to make future flights safer. But as Ernest K. Gann observed about aircraft crash investigations, sometimes we are left only with the feeling that some malevolent genie unzipped his pants and urinated on the pillar of science. As with all human creations, there are limits to technology, and there exists considerable potential for error in our most sophisticated machines. System redundancy, prior reliability, and the best quality control mankind can devise do not ensure perfection. This is worth contemplating as we prepare for a war that we expect will be a triumph of American technology. But the video game quality and 100-hour victory in our last military adventure in the Middle East may not be repeated. We go into space because we are a curious people, committed to exploring the frontiers of our universe. This need is among the most compelling human qualities. It is a sign of our optimism that we assume that we can overcome all obstacles that stand in the way of our goals. There is evidence to the contrary from the war of my generation, but it is unfashionable to mention Vietnam these days. And we are willing to take casualties to get what we want. We see them as the inevitable, if regrettable, cost of being the world's superpower. The war on which we appear about to embark carries with it a huge risk of disaster, Arab backlash, widespread death and destruction, environmental catastrophe. Following the September 11th attacks, our grief was laced with bewilderment. How could this have happened to us? Much the same response was on display this week when the space shuttle came apart. There is an arrogance implied in such a reaction. Unexpected death from terrorism and from technological failures has been a fact of life for a long time and promises to be part of our future. We may need a change in attitude in which we spend less time and emotional energy on puzzlement at our vulnerability to random calamity, and more on acceptance that we live in a dangerous world. We may need a determination to learn what we can from what happens with the knowledge that perfect safety will always elude us. What we should respect most about the Columbia astronauts is that they died in the pursuit of peaceful and humanly useful goals. They represented not just the best among us. They embodied our better selves. Those of our sons and daughters who may be about to die pursuing a process of unimaginable destruction are equally brave, well-motivated, and infinitely precious. Do we really want to ask this of them? Chapter 26. Heroism is sometimes stubbornness in the face of adversity. The Alexandria City Council voted unanimously yesterday to erect a privately financed $250,000 memorial to Vietnam prisoner of war Humbert Rock Rocky Versace, despite opposition to locating it in front of a busy recreation center. Washington Post, January 14, 2001. When I received an email in 2000 announcing a Veterans Day ceremony in Alexandria to honor Rocky Versace, I knew I had to go. That's Versace. He wasn't a fashion designer. Rocky was in my company at West Point. He lived just down the hall for a couple years. I liked him. He was a big, muscular guy with a sweet disposition, which meant a lot when I met him because I was a lowly plebe and he was an upperclassman with a license to make my life miserable. I always appreciated the fact that he didn't. In fact, Rocky was a little uneasy about himself. I think this modesty accounts, at least in part, for his ultimate heroism. In an environment that put a premium on aggressive, self-confident behavior, Rocky was unpretentious. Neither supremely intelligent nor gifted with what West Point saw as outstanding leadership qualities, he sticks in my memory as straightforward and determined, with a strong Catholic faith and a knack for saying odd things. In 1958, our company was chosen to go to Washington to participate in the interment in Arlington National Cemetery of the unknown soldier from the Korean War. The parade would cross Memorial Bridge. When we were being briefed on the route, Rocky raised his hand to ask, "Should we break step crossing the bridge?" He was referring to the practice of troops not marching in step across small wooden bridges to avoid damaging them with the vibration. Naturally, the question was greeted with hoots and guffaws and was seen as typically Rocky, earnest and a little out of it. That's how I remember him. Rocky's life after West Point was brief. In 1962, he was assigned as a special forces advisor to a South Vietnamese unit in the Mekong Delta. They were ambushed. He was shot and captured. He was imprisoned by the Viet Cong in the Hobo Woods, a huge swamp. He immediately tried to escape, dragging himself along because of his wounds. They recaptured and tortured him. But he attempted escape again and again. The VC, like good communists, attempted to indoctrinate him in their philosophy. The incentives for cooperation were obvious, but Rocky would have none of it and just argued and argued with them, eventually in their own language. We know this because my classmate, Nick Rao, was captured about this time and held in the same area. Nick escaped after 5 years imprisonment and wrote a book. He said Rocky was obstinate and suffered mightily for it. After 2 years, the VC executed him. I remember first hearing this story after Nick's escape and thinking, yep, that's Rocky. Stubborn. Some of his friends from long ago felt that in a culture that accords heroic stature to people who play games, Rocky's sacrifice deserved more recognition than it had received. They lobbied the military to award him the Congressional Medal of Honor, and they asked the city of Alexandria, where he had lived as a boy, to memorialize him in some other way. The first attempt was to get the school board to name an elementary school after him. He lost out for this honor to the late civil rights attorney Samuel Wilbert Tucker. Finally, the city council was persuaded to give space for a privately funded memorial at the Mount Vernon Recreation Center. A design competition was held and a sculptor selected. Then a Veterans Day ceremony was scheduled at the center to honor Rocky and preview the memorial plan. When I showed up, the place was being picketed by a half dozen people from the surrounding neighborhood. The scene was a prescription for discomfort. A bunch of aging white soldiers coming to establish a memorial to one of their own in front of a recreation center in a black neighborhood. Nobody wanted to make a racial thing out of it. The picketers, and later speakers in front of the city council, talked about the lack of community involvement in the review process. The white guys invoked patriotism and the dubious hope that the children using the center would find ennobling the statue of Rocky with a couple Vietnamese kids. Pete Dawkins, the most famous undergraduate of my generation, gave the keynote. He was 63, but he still looked fit enough to win that Heisman Trophy all over again. I played a little hockey with Pete a long time ago, but he didn't remember me. He was good. I wasn't. When he left the Army as a brigadier general, he went on to become a master of the universe on Wall Street. He made a run for the Senate from New Jersey and lost. Now, here he was, speaking about his classmate Rocky. He called him hugely courageous and indomitably spirited, which Rocky certainly was. Though I doubted that he and Pete had been good friends. I just couldn't see them moving in the same circles at West Point. But you have to make allowances at a memorial service. Other highlights of the ceremony included a couple choral numbers by some kids who used the center, and an agile dance on the political tightrope by the photogenic mayor of Alexandria, who declared that he had objected to that war, though not, he hastened to add, to the participants. I can almost see the road sign, Vietnam Participants Memorial Highway. Into this curious patriotic mix came Miss America 2000, who led us in God Bless America, the anthem that Rocky is reported to have loudly sung when he was isolated as incorrigible by his captors. Improbable by war story standards, but it does sound like something Rocky might do, both to keep up his spirits and to annoy the VC. The ceremony concluded with a passable rendition of Taps, always a risky undertaking for a bugler in front of an audience that has heard that mournful call played well and poorly on so many evenings in so many distant places. We adjourned to the vestibule to see a model of the memorial, and then departed into the cool fall sunshine, passing the demonstrators who looked at us across a gulf of race and time and memory. They wondered, no doubt, as we did, what are those people thinking? Epilogue. After years of efforts by his friends and classmates, the Army finally awarded Rocky the Congressional Medal of Honor. Chapter 27. Life is not a spectator sport. The world is a dangerous place, not because of the people who are evil, but because of the people who don't do anything about it. Albert Einstein. Most acts of power-based violence occur in the presence of others. This is especially true in social settings, such as bars or parties on college campuses in which men frequently behave in predatory ways toward women. A large number of sexual assaults involve the consumption of enough alcohol to impair a woman's ability to consent. In situations like these, the sequence from the point of view of the man involves target identification, superficially charming and flattering behavior, drinking to lower inhibitions and increase the woman's vulnerability, and then moving to a private setting where the sexual contact takes place. Because the initial phases of this sequence occur in public, Usually other people can see what is happening. How they react is the key to whether a sexual assault occurs. The largest group of bystanders consists of those who remain passive and rationalize what is happening as none of my business. We observe the same phenomenon elsewhere when a majority of people who witness violence or some other form of injustice do not intervene. A common example would be an adult hitting or rebuking a child in public. Most of us have been present when this is happening. How many of us have done anything to stop it? The question is, how much risk are we prepared to take on behalf of a stranger? People's explanations for not getting involved often revolve around fear for their own safety, but this fear does not explain many people's reluctance to make even a risk-free phone call when a violent crime is being committed in front of them. Perhaps the most famous incident illustrating bystander passivity in the face of violence was the 1964 murder of Kitty Genovese in New York City. A young woman was attacked on the street at 3 a.m., for over half an hour, while an undetermined number of witnesses failed to call police in the face of her screams for help. In 2010, Simone Black, a woman from the United Kingdom, posted a suicide note on her Facebook page. None of her 1,082 Facebook friends responded effectively, and she went on to kill herself. The bystander phenomenon is well known experimentally in the field of social psychology. The number of spectators present at any incident seems to be important. The more witnesses to an event that invites intervention, the less likely people are to act. A kind of diffusion of responsibility apparently occurs that causes each person to assume that someone else will intervene. We all also depend on social cues to decide whether to do anything. If one is in a group witnessing an act of violence and no one else is interceding, we are less likely to take action individually. Whatever the explanation, our failure to help people in distress is a form of cowardice that ought to be addressed, especially in settings such as college campuses, where sexual assaults of women that begin in social situations is a pressing problem. Training programs are now being designed to alert people to the phenomenon that tends to freeze us when we are faced with circumstances in which another person is in danger. Although we cannot expect everyone to throw themselves in the path of an oncoming train to save a stranger, most situations requiring bystander intervention are physically less risky and more slowly developing. So we have time to consider whether to do something to stop what is happening. A lot of attention has been given of late to the phenomenon of bullying, notably in school, though it can occur anywhere, at any age. The intimidation of a weaker person by a stronger one usually takes place in the presence of others, and steps to prevent it invariably involve attempts to encourage people to intervene. Again, such efforts must overcome familiar dynamics and the bystander phenomenon. Fear for one's own safety. Diffusion of responsibility, a perception that certain people bring this misfortune on themselves, and the traditional need for scapegoats that many groups manifest. Teaching children that they have a responsibility to prevent the humiliation and coercion of another is difficult. It is even harder to convince adults not accustomed to taking risks to do so. The form of bullying called stalking is similarly receiving legal attention because of its sometimes lethal outcomes. Most of the teaching that we provide our children on how to behave in the presence of strangers is cautionary and designed to keep them safe. Don't talk to strangers. Very little attention is given on how to confront situations in which a stranger needs help. These attitudes are the genesis for the reluctance of bystanders to get involved. Forces in the society that devote themselves to concerns about others are opposed by a culture of selfishness that argues that we must not risk what we have. There exist philosophical and political disagreements about the issue of our obligations to each other. So, for example, the homeless become invisible or annoying. When our capacity for empathy is breached, we become less attuned to the idea that any stranger in distress might be us or someone we love. So we turn away and go on with our lives. Our souls shrivel a little each time this happens. Chapter 28. One of the greatest risks is to be honest with ourselves. If I am not for myself, who will be for me? If I am only for myself, what am I? And if not now, when? Hillel. To claim any virtue, especially courage, we must manifest it in our behavior, the way we live. In an effort to seem closer to our ideal selves, we all employ some level of deceit in constructing the narrative of our lives. This habit becomes uniquely self-destructive when we begin to believe things about ourselves that are false. If we aspire to be brave, we must practice bravery in small ways so that we will be prepared when more is required of us. The cardinal virtues are kindness and courage. Most of the other traits we manifest or seek to develop are derivative. From kindness, for example, comes empathy, tolerance, and beauty. From courage, we derive honesty, loyalty, and optimism. In creating that version of ourselves that we present to the world, most of us would like to be seen as brave. It is common to invent an autobiography that contains examples of admirable behavior, athletic achievements, war stories, moments when we did something risky. On some internet sites, you can purchase medals for valor to wear as if earned. We search so hard for heroes to inspire us that the word hero itself has lost much of its meaning. But we still recognize, at least in the abstract, that taking risks on behalf of others deserves recognition. As we inventory our own lives, we are sometimes surprised at how safe and comfortable they have been. The riskiest thing that most of us are required to do is drive our cars. When we encounter circumstances such as a health crisis, we are often astounded, as if such misfortune was not a routine consequence of being human. Because risk brings with it excitement, some of us seek it out in the form of hazardous recreation or gambling. What makes these pursuits different from displays of courage is that no one else stands to benefit from what we do. We are simply increasing our own rush of adrenaline, like injecting a drug that produces a temporary euphoria. So to the elements of choice and risk, perhaps we ought to add usefulness to someone besides ourselves as a component of true courage. In fact, this latter quality may be more important than the degree of risk to allow us to include in our heroic pantheon people such as inner-city teachers or skilled medical professionals. If, as I believe, self-absorption is the personal characteristic that most threatens our ability to live peacefully with each other, why not award valor medals to those who manifest their feelings of generosity, empathy, and obligation to others, even if they are not risking their lives in the process? One of the ironies of the capitalist system is that the largest material rewards go to the most selfish and acquisitive among us, while those who dedicate their lives to the benefit of others are customarily the least compensated. Of late, the political term used by those who would defend the interests of the rich is to refer to their wealthy constituents as job creators. Could our language be further degraded or used to obfuscate the truth? This trend appears to have started when the War Department was renamed the Department of Defense. Being honest with ourselves requires more than an unsparing inventory of our personal strengths and weaknesses. We must also try to speak to each other plainly about things that matter. So we have some bad habits to break. For example, any sentence from a politician that begins with the words, "the American people," think, feel, want, don't want, will not tolerate, and so on, will be followed by the speaker's own thoughts, desires, or ideology. The use of euphemisms and the passive voice mistakes were made, is another tip-off that we are being lied to. If we elect to high office people who speak to us this way, we get the government that we deserve. Although we are all prone to reworking our pasts to fit with our present needs, we cannot rewrite history. For example, the Founding Fathers did not anticipate corporate financing of elections, gays in the military, or the right of every citizen to own an assault rifle. One of the most necessary forms of courage to all of us, individually and as a society, is the courage to change. Time forces this upon us as we age, and we have few models of graceful acceptance. Our relationships with each other are regulated by a system of laws that also requires continual evaluation and evolution. In this process, certain permanent truths must guide us. 1. It is wrong to treat another person as an object. 2. We are all in this together. 3. The measure of any society is how it treats its most vulnerable citizens. 4. Fear brings out the worst in us. We must not yield to it. 5. If we lived forever, there would be no such thing as courage. Chapter 29. At the heart of anger is sadness. Now is the time to understand more so that we may fear less. Marie Curie. As we try to make sense of and to derive meaning from our lives, we are impeded by the many losses, mistakes, and resentments that attend the human condition. To weave a coherent narrative from our experience, we are tempted to blame others for what has happened to us. On a personal level, this sometimes causes us to become injustice collectors, in which complaint becomes our standard mode of communication. In escaping this perpetual aura of grievance, we have to both take responsibility for what happens to us and acknowledge the role of chance in shaping all our lives. Our ability to live in harmony with each other requires relinquishing blame and replacing it with the idea of shared fate and the spirit of compromise that acknowledges that none of us has a monopoly on the truth. In my professional life, people come to me to change. Usually they are experiencing unwanted feelings such as anxiety and depression that have become so burdensome that they are interfering with their lives, especially their ability to relate to others in a satisfying way. The mechanisms they have adopted to cope with these feelings, denial, avoidance, blaming others, self-medication, have not worked. In fact, these efforts have commonly made things worse. Because they do not know where these feelings come from, they have no idea how to get rid of them. They would like some advice, or imagine that I can give them a medicine or a set of directions that will make them feel better. They are frequently impatient. They have been watching therapists on television who seem to get to the heart of the matter in minutes. They have worked with other professionals with different ideas about how people change and have not been helped. I feel some pressure to perform. And so begins what might be described as an educational effort in the service of understanding, which, if all goes well, will lead to different behaviors and feelings, in that order. I try to convince them that an examination of the past that is as honest as our fallible memories will allow will yield information that will help them in the future. And I attempt to hold them in place long enough so that we can develop a relationship, a sense of mutual confidence, even affection, that will give them hope. None of us put much stock in advice from strangers, though the popularity of self-help books suggests otherwise. Only when we know and respect someone do they have the leverage to make interpretations, ask uncomfortable questions, and encourage us to look below the surface of our lives. This sense of being understood is why the therapeutic relationship is infinitely more important than the therapist's theoretical beliefs about what causes people to change. a secret about psychotherapy, at least with me. To help someone, I have to like them, and they have to like me. Complaint is not a useful or attractive way of relating to the world, which is why much of our political discourse is so unappealing. Instead of constructive ideas about what each of us can do to solve problems, most politicians and people who comment about politics prefer to blame the people they disagree with for what is wrong. Often this blaming takes the form of a sense of victimization, in which the other side is portrayed as seeking to oppress, deceive, or otherwise disadvantage the forces of reason and righteousness. These complaints can reach absurd levels, as when the white, privileged majority feels attacked by those arguing in favor of the wealthy paying more taxes, or keeping government out of our bedrooms, or making health care affordable for all. These feelings of being threatened by a changing society are among our most destructive fears. The absurdity of these anxieties is demonstrated by the recent finding that the wealth gap between whites and minorities has grown to its widest levels in a half a century. According to census data, whites on average now have 20 times the net worth of blacks and 18 times that of Hispanics, $113,000 versus $5,000 to $6,000. Yet a significant segment of white society feels threatened and protective of their advantages. Our political discourse has been degraded by the rise of an angry and self-righteous segment of the population that thinks it is legitimate to impose their vision of the future by threatening to damage our political and economic systems if they don't get their way. This threat is but a short step from violence, which, for example, among some religious extremists, has replaced peaceful protest in the area of reproductive rights. When hateful accusations replace reasoned discourse, then compromise, the basis for any democratic system, becomes impossible, and all we are left with are statements of faith and assertions that some people are better than others in interpreting God's will. In this direction lies theocracy and the loss of freedom to follow the light of our own conscience. The role that fear plays in this process is obvious. If we imagine that others wish to impose their will on us in the name of some belief system, we feel justified in opposing this process by whatever means necessary. If we feel the need to arm ourselves to constrain the power of our own government, we have lost some basic trust that our voices will be heard and that we can effect change by peaceful political means. If we believe that our president holds office illegitimately because he was not born in this country, we are making a statement that is not just divorced from provable reality, but is also a fear-driven, delusional rejection of our system of government. Like all conspiracy theories, it satisfies some fundamental need to see ourselves as victims who must resort to extreme measures to protect what we are and what we have against nefarious forces that would obliterate us. Such beliefs also imply contempt for those who disagree with us. Who can be tolerant of or seek compromise with people whom we are convinced threaten our very existence? How can reasonable people argue against such fears? When treating patients in the grip of anxiety, a diffuse form of fear, logical argument has its limits. As I have commented elsewhere, it is difficult to remove by logic an idea not placed there by logic in the first place. In our political discourse, we see numerous examples of people behaving illogically, as when elderly people who benefit from Medicare and Social Security rage against government entitlement programs, especially universal health care, or people who buy guns after a mass shooting. Most of our fears are misplaced. Remember the relentless advance of the killer bees? But we are at risk of fulfilling them by our irrational reactions. The stock market, driven by fear and greed, oscillates wildly in times of stress and economic uncertainty. We engage in wars when threatened by stateless terrorists respond to our invasions by moving their operations to other countries. Just as in psychotherapy, in our political discourse, there is no substitute for looking below the surface of the stories we are told. Identifying the sadness and fear that underlies anger, the insecurity that expresses itself in arrogance, and the sense of meaninglessness behind most unhappiness. If we can apply this understanding to our political disagreements, we might be able to differ with each other with a little more humility and a little less certainty that only those who believe as we do deserve to be saved. And in this process, we might just find more to like and admire in each other, and in ourselves. Chapter 30. The quest for courage is a journey within. The journey between what you once were and who you are now becoming is where the dance of life really takes place. Barbara DeAngelis. We assembled in March 1995 at San Francisco Airport, a group of graying, overweight, middle-aged men. We were veterans of the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, Black Horse, and had served in Vietnam sometime between 1966 and 1971. We were retracing our journey into a war that none of us fully understood, then or now. We had survived to return to the world and made of our lives what we could. But unexpectedly, we carried Vietnam home with us and left some part of ourselves there. Now we were going back, each with his own story, each for his own reasons. Accompanying me was my 25-year-old Amerasian son, Michael, whom I had met as a newborn in Saigon near the end of my tour in 1969. I hoped that he might discover there something important about his connection to the earth and to that place. We planned some attempts to find his birth mother, but the success of this task seemed unlikely in the 10 days of our trip. On the final leg of the flight from Manila to Vietnam, I remembered having the same view 26 years before from the right side of a TWA 707. I wondered as we crossed the coast whether I would see, as I did in 1968, the moonscape of B-52 bomb craters that brought together in my mind our two great national adventures of the 1960s, the race to the moon and the Vietnam War, each so different in intent and result. One, the signal success of my generation, the other, our greatest failure. As we made our approach to Tan Son Nhut Airport, only peaceful villages and rice paddies could be seen. Was it possible that all signs of our presence there had been expunged like the filled-in bomb craters? We stepped off the aircraft into blast furnace heat, like a living presence that made us remember where we were. Before we boarded the bus to the hotel, we were approached by young Vietnamese women wearing traditional Ao Dai, who handed us bouquets of flowers. Only later did I read that half the current population of Vietnam was not even born when last we were here. The following day, we met some of our one-time adversaries at the Ho Chi Minh City Veterans Association. There were no hints of animosity, and I thought this must be easier for them. They had won, after all. Gifts were exchanged, and we each received a small oil lamp used by the VC to light their bunkers and tunnels, most of which we never found. That lamp sits on my desk as I write this. The next day, I took Michael to the Tu Du Maternity Hospital, where he was born. With its stucco walls and treed courtyard, it looked exactly as it did when I found him there so long ago. Although we failed in our attempts to locate his birth mother, I think that just coming back to the place of his birth was enough for this visit. He made a connection and vowed to return. We boarded a tour bus and began our journey into the past. We went first to Long Binh, a huge American base during the war. Nothing is left. It has been obliterated. I remembered the hospitals, a giant post exchange, swimming pools, even a Chinese restaurant. All gone. We stopped at the site of our old Black Horse base camp. The place is peaceful now, with widely spaced houses adjacent to a Vietnamese military complex. Some of the veterans, dropping to their knees, were able to excavate artifacts from our time there. An unexpended .30-caliber bullet, a rusted sea ration can, a couple short lengths of barbed wire. One of the group put a little of the coarse soil into a film canister to take home. I broke away from the main body and spent a day alone in a van traveling to the area of operations where the most intense combat I recall took place. I found some of the villages I remembered. I wanted to see if the bullet-pocked monument in one of them, memorializing the local soldiers who died with the French in their own lost war in Vietnam, still stood. It was gone. Part of the cleansing of the country of all traces of both us and our South Vietnamese allies. I remember that moment as providing an epiphany for me. How could we succeed where the French had failed 13 years before? How much like them we must have looked to the people of that village. The guide turned to me at one point and asked hesitantly, "What do you think of the MIA problem?" This was not the last time I was asked that question by English-speaking Vietnamese. I finally understood their mystification that the 1,617 American soldiers and airmen still missing were such a barrier to normalizing relations between our two countries. The American preoccupation with our lost countrymen, especially the fantasy that some may still be POWs, seems odd to the Vietnamese, in view of the fact that more than 300,000 North Vietnamese and Viet Cong troops remain unaccounted for. "I think they're dead," I responded. The guide nodded sadly and told of the family members of MIAs she had accompanied to remote villages where they vainly asked after their loved ones. We stopped next in Bên Suc, the hamlet leveled in Operation Cedar Falls in 1967, and the site of the memorable explanation by an army officer to a TV reporter, "We had to destroy the village in order to save it." We traversed the infamous Iron Triangle, pausing at the remains of an American M48 tank of the sort we used in the 11th Armored Cavalry. It was curious to see the veterans climbing on it. An "I Rode with Black Horse" bumper sticker was irreverently affixed to the main gun, like an effort to console ourselves at this tangible symbol of our defeat. Roads and airfields are the only permanent signs of our having been there. Pierced steel planking with which airstrips were covered is now in evidence in backyard fences. Old .50-caliber ammunition boxes serve as flower pots. At Tay Ninh, we stopped at the Martyrs' Cemetery, the resting place for 12,000 liberation soldiers, their equivalent to our Arlington. We laid flowers and burned incense. The ceremony brought one of our guides, Colonel Can, to tears as he remembered his son dead at Khe Sanh. His grief evoked something from all of us, and each vet touched his shoulder or shook his hand as we reboarded the bus. To visit the Chu Chi tunnels, only 30 miles from Saigon, is to learn why we lost the war. The elaborate, painstaking construction and concealment by the Viet Cong, which extended over 20 years, shows a determination that no amount of technology could overcome. The huge B-52 bomb craters preserved there are monuments to the futility of trying to destroy more than 200 miles of tunnel that hid entire battalions of fighters, while our tanks and infantry maneuvered above. In war, as in life, there is little that will not yield to persistence and a belief in time as a stream carving its way slowly through the rock of resistance. They did not need to win. They had only to endure until our Western impatience and moral uncertainty caused us to depart. It was a relief at last to see the ground fall away, and the coastline of Vietnam fade behind us. Some scattered applause from the veterans was reminiscent of the cheers on the departing Freedom Bird in 1969. This, I knew, was my last trip to the place that had such an effect on my life, on all our lives. I was filled with a sadness that I could not define. I was flying back to those who care about me, both for who I once was and who I am now. And whatever I left unfinished was Michael's to seek and find. I have, after all, had my time. Perhaps this was my regret. When I went there in my youth, it was to an adventure. I sensed that the war would be the defining event of my generation. My country was divided, and I faced challenges both to my manhood and my humanity. Since then, I have grown old. I think this return trip helped most of us, seeing Vietnam at peace and the people friendly and unafraid. Perhaps that is as much closure as we are entitled to. We can't bring back the dead, ours or theirs. We seem to be forgiven by those who remember us at all. We might as well forgive ourselves and come home at last, each with whatever separate peace he can attain. The years have leached from us the passions of youth, misdirected as they were into war. On our journey, we failed at recapturing what we were and felt. The shape of the land has changed, as has the topography of our spirits. We vainly tried to orient ourselves with old maps which no longer fit the ground on which we walked. The young people who took us from place to place must have wondered what we were looking for, not knowing what it is we remember. We carried the burdens of time and fate, and our hearts were weighted with the knowledge of those who cannot return, and whose stories are lost to all except those who loved them. We hope you've enjoyed The Thing You Think You Cannot Do, an Oasis audio production under arrangement with Da Capo Press, a member of the Perseus Books Group. Text copyright 2012 by Gordon Livingston. Production copyright 2012 by Oasis Audio, under arrangement with Da Capo Press, a member of the Perseus Books Group. Oasis audio titles are available wherever audiobooks are sold and on our website, oasisaudio.com.